Our collective nightmare, a new Netflix short, walks into bedrooms and leaves with our national alibi. The film is called All the Empty Rooms. It is polite. It is tasteful. It circles the evidence like museum guards and calls the silence empathy. Kids who never finished high school or even a full season of middle school still have rooms. The rooms sit frozen. Pink stuffed dogs wait on unmade beds. A retainer sleeps in a drawer. A trinket box holds letters a 13-year-old wrote to herself about caramel frappuccinos and first day nerves. String lights blink. A teddy bear still laughs on a loop. A tube of toothpaste gapes open. Hair ties hang on doorknobs like tiny wreaths for memory. Photographers took pictures. A correspondent drove across the country and said the rooms make him hyperventilate. Parents keep the rooms just as they were. Some will not wash laundry because the smell is the only proof left that a child lived. Some will not move for years because moving feels like betrayal. One family finally packed a few things, moved, and renamed a fire pit Gracie's Point. They will make s'mores there and tell themselves that counts as healing. The film is careful. It never says the word most Americans expect to hear. It has no agenda beyond empathy. It gives picture books and cinematic frames and keeps the lights on in rooms where children were taken. It shows everything that remains and avoids the part that made the rooms empty. This has become our ritual. We make art from absence. We stage sanctuaries of sorrow and call that resistance. We photograph tragedy and hand out empathy pamphlets while the rest of the machinery clanks on unchanged. We perform grief like a civic duty and expect it to substitute for revision. The rooms are intimate. They are also a map of failure. Childhood things, books, trophies, stuffed animals, mismatched socks, line shelves like small indictments. Parents lie on beds to remember the texture of a scalp. They hold objects as if objects could be proxy children. They keep lights on and voices recorded in toy paws. We watch these images at night, which is where the market prefers them, and then we return to our roles. There is a resigned absurdity to photographing absence and calling it enlightenment. The pictures are beautiful. The movie is humane. The country remains uninterested in the work that would stop bedrooms from becoming exhibits. Empathy is cheap. Policy and courage are not. We are very good at making altars. We are terrible at making prevention. We will keep lighting string lights and making picture books and naming lakeside fire pits. We will keep preserving smell and laundry and laughter as if preservation is the same as safety. We will keep treating grief as a national pastime. The film hands parents a glossy book and a camera angle. The film offers solace in images. The film keeps one word in another room. The rest of us keep watching. That is the system working exactly as advertised, tender, tasteful, and terminally inert.
The moon is having another glow-up, and humanity's reaction is exactly what you'd expect. Hysteria, humility, and hashtags. This week, we get the last supermoon of the year. The cold moon, which sounds like a mood ring for the sky, it's full because it's opposite the sun. And it's a supermoon because the moon decided to swing by Earth's VIP section and get closer. The moon is literally doing cardio, and we're all passive-aggressively impressed. Native communities had names for this moon long before we slapped cold on it for marketing. Cherokee called it the snow moon, Abenaki the winter maker moon. Those are useful names. Ours translates to, ooh, it's chilly and photogenic. Classic. This moon rises at sunset, which means two things. It's beautiful, and it ruins your carefully curated Instagram timeline because everyone and their mother, including that one friend whose camera still says HDR on, will be outside taking the same shot of the exact same rock. People will complain their iPhone makes it a bright blob. Amateur astrophotographers will whine that it makes the rest of their weekend plans obsolete. Influencers will stand in front of it with a latte and a faux philosophical caption about basking in cosmic energy while their latte goes cold. Scientists, meanwhile, are trying to talk about perigee and Artemis missions, and we're like, good for you. Does it sync with my Apple Watch? There's Apollo nostalgia too. Apollo 8 and 17 anniversaries are this month, as if space history were a holiday sale. Buy one lunar orbit, get a Christmas Eve broadcast free. And yes, Artemis 2 is on the calendar for 2026, which sounds suitably epic until you remember people in suburbia can't even agree on where to park for the Christmas lights display. The bright winter moon looks extra dramatic because the trees aren't blocking the light. Translation: nature is doing a lighting upgrade and your neighbor's inflatable Santa still looks tacky. Expect earnest bumper stickers about the cosmos, passive-aggressive group texts planning a moon watch, and at least one WA threatening to fine you for setting up a tripod on the lawn. The meteor showers that follow will be the background music for everyone pretending to be deeply moved by the universe between bites of holiday pie. The real punchline: Humans get sentimental about the moon while arguing over seating at a winter party. We revere the same celestial body that NASA used to send brave people into orbit, then use it as the backdrop for our dinner plans and low-res selfies. The moon was there before our feelings. It'll be there after our Wi-Fi dies. But for one chilly night, we'll all be outside looking up, complaining that it's too bright, not cinematic enough, and somehow ruining our aesthetic, while promising to learn more about it after the holidays.
The government will now seed $1,000 into the bank of your newborn and call it progress. Welcome to the Trump account, a tiny branded starter fund that guarantees every U.S.-born baby, if their parents have Social Security numbers, becomes a little piece of the stock market from day one. Here's the sales pitch boiled down. Kids born from January 1st, 2025 to December 31st, 2028 get $1,000 from Uncle Sam. Families and friends can top it up starting July 4th, 2026, but no more than $5,000 a year in total. Employers may pony up to $2, $500 of that. The money must live in a low-cost U.S. stock index fund. The Treasury channels the initial money. The IRS expects parents to file a new form 4547 to open an account. Withdrawals are locked until age 18, and the cash is supposed to be used for college, buying a home, or starting a small business. A charitable twist, Michael and Susan. Dell are donating billions to reach more kids. Their gift will put $250 into accounts for many children under 10 who were born before 2025 and live in zip codes with median incomes under $150,000. An oddly generous cutoff that still feels like private philanthropy covering what the state will not. The Dells expect to reach at least 25 million kids, and if funds remain, older children might get in too. Notice the clause. The program is sold as universal, but eligibility hinges on U.S. birth and Social Security numbers for both parents and the baby, an automatic exclusion of undocumented families and many immigrants. The universal label looks thin when the safety net has a paperwork lock on it. Making the accounts mandatory investments in U.S. stock indexes means your child's future now rides on corporate profits and market whims. A market crash is not a family tragedy. It's a national downsizing of childhood savings. There's also the creeping corporate hand. Employers can contribute. That's convenient. If you like the idea of workplaces nudging family finances and branding themselves into your kids' bank statements, philanthropists get to play Robin Hood Light, distributing small checks, scoring massive PR, and leaving the broader structural problem. Stagnant wages, rising costs, unequal access to opportunity, untouched. Critics are right to call this regressive. Flat giveaways reward everyone the same, which looks nice until you remember the people who need help most are the least likely to meet the fine print. And the Trump account doesn't simplify anything. It adds another account to the maze of 529s, IRAs, custodial accounts, and tax rules that families already navigate. The Tax Foundation points out that existing 529s can be more flexible and tax-friendly, which makes the Trump account feel less like innovation and more like another layer of political packaging. So the state will plant a seed in your child's financial life, a $1,000 label, a market mandate, and a lockbox until adulthood. Wealthy donors will sprinkle a few $100 into selected zip codes, and corporations will be invited to help fund the upbringing of future consumers and entrepreneurs. If the market behaves, some kids will get a leg up. If it doesn't, childhood becomes another investment casualty. Call it compassion with the ticker tape. Call it branding for the cradle. Either way, it's another small law, another little normalizing step toward a world where citizenship comes with an account number, not a guarantee.
From an interview broadcast on CNN with Anderson Cooper, original title, musician Nick Cave talks to Anderson Cooper about how the loss of two sons widened his capacity for love. Grief has a strange economy. You lose something irreplaceable and the ledger balances not with emptiness, but with a curious surplus, more room for feeling. It's the sort of cruel arithmetic that makes you want to laugh because crying feels like the only honest alternative. Nick Cave's remark that loss widened his capacity for love reads like a paradox or a bad marketing slogan for the human heart. We trade pieces of ourselves at random and somehow come back heavier with feeling. It's as if the universe keeps handing out emotional upgrades through a process that looks suspiciously like injury. Why does this happen? Maybe love is less a fixed stockpile and more a muscle. Stress it with essence and it grows. Or maybe we invent meaning in the rubble because not inventing is unbearable. Either way, humans are exceptionally good at turning catastrophe into narrative, and even better at mistaking that narrative for truth. There's irony in thinking loss can enrich you. It's an absurd consolation prize. Congratulations, you now love more. Please accept this certificate and continue. But the irony doesn't erase the tenderness. If anything, the absurdity highlights it. Against the indifferent machinery of events, we respond with stubborn care. Existentially, this gives us two options. One, stare at the cold, uninterested cosmos until your face goes numb. Two, let the feeling that follows pain widen you, awkwardly and unwillingly, until you surprise yourself with what you can bear and what you can give. Most people pivot between both, which is probably the intended human experience. The real lesson isn't heroic. It's small and domestic. Grief reshapes where we keep our warmth. It sneaks into ordinary moments. A song, a cup of coffee, a half-remembered joke. And there, without fanfare, the capacity to love quietly expands. So, if life is a series of losses that teach us how to love better, the joke is on us and also, inconveniently, true. We emerge less innocent and more capable, carrying the obvious absurdity that sometimes the only way to see the world with more devotion is to watch pieces of it go dark.
The capitalist fever dream, a lifetime ban from a trade association, reads like a clearance sale on a ruined reputation. The American Economic Association, 17,000 members, and a brand that certifies credibility, has locked Larry Summers out of its events, journals, and refereeing rooms, accepting his voluntary resignation as if it were a tidy accounting adjustment. Summers is a product with pedigree: Treasury Secretary, Harvard President, John Bates Clark Medal. That pedigree used to be convertible into influence, board seats, speaking fees. When decades of networked favors and private correspondences were spilled into the public ledger, the collateral value of that pedigree took a hit. Not because justice demanded it, but because reputational capital has a market and the market reacted. The House Committee's emails are a balance sheet of moral bankruptcy. Sexist remarks traded like memos, requests for romantic advice, routed through a convicted predator as if intimacy and access were commodities to be brokered. Epstein was not an outlier. He was a middleman in a market where access and indulgence were priced and paid for by elites. Institutions respond the way corporations do, by cutting liabilities and protecting brand equity. Harvard pauses teaching, OpenAI accepts a board resignation, the AEA stages a lifetime prohibition. These are not moral reckonings, so much as recall notices. Remove the defective part. Continue production. The spectacle of sanction is less about correction than damage control for donors, funders, and the credential renting marketplace. Condemnation replaces accountability. A lifetime ban from an association is simultaneously severe and theatrical. It signals adherence to standards while leaving intact the systems that produce the problem. Summers' professional network is not dissolved by an edict. It is merely inconvenienced. The marketplace of prestige recalibrates, prices shift, and new intermediaries step into the vacancy. This episode exposes an economy where reputation is a tradable asset, and ethical failures are line items on a ledger. The sick logic is simple: maximize access, monetize influence, shield the brand when exposure threatens revenue. When private vice becomes public scandal, institutions posture to preserve their cash flows and consumer confidence in the product they sell. Expertise, authority, legitimacy. What was criminal becomes collateral. What was immoral becomes a PR problem. The fury of the moment does not transform the underlying market incentives that let a predator operate beside presidents and provosts. It only rearranges the chairs on a deck that keeps tilting toward profit. The ban is a symbol, not a cure. It is a fever dream of corrective action in a system that rewards proximity to power and punishes the unlucky, the exposed, and the expendable. The real collapse is not a scandal. It is the steady commodification of trust, where mentor and market are one and the same, and the cost of complicity is always written off as an unfortunate business expense.